content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I'll read an article from the August 11th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, How to Live Forever and Get Rich Doing It. As researchers work to make death optional, investors see a chance for huge returns. But has the human body already reached its limits? By Tad Friend. Peter Diamandis is 5'4" and has pipe stem legs, but his torso widens into broad shoulders, powerful biceps, and a craggy Homeric head. The composite effect is of a genie emerging from a lamp. Our wish is his command, and our wish, surely, must be for more time to make wishes, for limitless life. In December, Diamandis stood before 200 doctors and scientists and vowed that in the coming decade our wish would become true. It's either a hardware problem or a software problem, and we're going to be able to fix that, he said. Diamandis was at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, north of San Francisco, to address the round table of the longevity clinics. He wore his customary outfit, black sneakers, black jeans, and a black t-shirt. Having one look and one message, life just gets more abundant, spares him decision fatigue. An ebullient spirit whose confidence is tempered at times by his reverence for data, he acknowledged that the task was immense. We have 40 trillion cells in our body, and every cell is running 1 to 2 billion chemical reactions per second, he said. It is not possible for any human to understand this. We are linear thinkers in an exponential world. Yet, with robots soon able to run a million experiments a day, and with AI poised to parse our cellular code, how long could immortality take? He observed that his clients at Fountain Life, a longevity clinic he established, were already on their way to freedom from disease. They'd have early access to emergent tech, such as blood filter, that can filter out metastatic cancer, and a transmitter that uses high-frequency waves to diagnose strokes and zap depression. Remission in a week with 10 minutes per day therapy. Diamandis, who is 64, has a bachelor's in molecular genetics and a master's in aerospace engineering from MIT, as well as a medical degree from Harvard. But he's not a practicing doctor, engineer, or scientist. He's an emissary from the realms of possibility. After growing up on Long Island in a family of Greek immigrants, he began making his dent in the universe by founding some 24 businesses, many of which involved voyaging to space. As a young entrepreneur, he formulated Peter's Laws, which included, if you can't win, change the rules, and when forced to compromise, ask for more. He promotes the inevitability of longevity through a multitude of channels. There's the clinic, which he started with two doctors and the motivational speaker Tony Robbins. There's a newsletter, two podcasts and books on the future and how to stick around for it. There are partnerships and venture funds devoted to AI and biotech, an annual conference, Abundance 360, which showcases advances in nanotechnology and brain-computer interfaces, and a semi-annual platinum trip where, for $70,000 apiece, people get to meet eminent longevity scientists, invest in their experimental therapies, and secure those therapies for personal use. The Diamandis Network, known to its constituents as the Peterverse, is largely peopled by slim, graying, well-off men. America's richest now live a dozen years longer than its poorest, and they intend to widen their lead. Jeff Bezos, Yuri Milner, and Sam Altman have all funded anti-aging research. Joel Hunzinga, the CEO of Iguaceutical, a startup whose water-based drink aims to reverse cellular age, told me, "We don't work in mice, we work in billionaires." Near the back of the buck sat the biological theorist Aubrey de Grey, stroking a beard the size of a beagle. In 2004, DeGray coined the phrase longevity escape velocity to describe the moment when science stops us from getting older so that, with further advances, we can begin growing younger. At the time, DeGray was viewed as a brilliant crackpot. He is now seen as a sort of Alfred Wegener, whose theory of continental drift lacked only a practical understanding of how it might work. The rise in DeGray's reputation corresponds to Diamandis' long struggle to encourage longevity research by establishing a prize, his favorite promotional device. In 1996, Diamandis launched the X Prize, a $10 million award for advances in commercial spaceflight. 8 years later, a team funded by the Microsoft founder Paul Allen sent a manned rocket aloft and won. XPRIZE went on to establish lucrative awards in domains as diverse as carbon capture, deep ocean exploration, and literacy software for children. In 2007, DeGray suggested a longevity prize. Diamandis loved the idea. Ever since med school, when he learned that Greenland sharks can live for 5 centuries, he wondered, why not us? But impediments loomed. There was no agreed-upon framework for interventions. Aging isn't even classified as a disease by the FDA. And there was no obvious way to measure competing therapies, short of running a protracted competition to see how long it took participants to die. Perhaps most important, none of the more than 50 billionaires whom Diamandis approached to fund the prize seemed to believe you could turn back time. The field gradually caught up to him, though. Health became a competition, encouraged by the advent of watches that track your vital signs and biomarker-based clocks that measure your aging. Podcasters converted sad sack men into biohackers who juiced themselves with everything from Ayurvedic herbs to electromagnetic frequency beds. Most biohackers are men for the same reason that most gambling addicts are men. In 2013, there were fewer than 100 longevity clinics around the globe. A decade later, there were more than 3,000. So, at the Buck Institute, Diamandis declared that he'd finally been able to establish a prize in longevity. The goal was to devise a treatment by 2030 that made patients' muscles, brains, and immune systems 20 years younger. The winning team would get as much as $81 million. David Sinclair, a prominent geneticist whose lab recently reversed the effective age of cells in lab animals, told me that the prize had galvanized the field. It's helped change the focus from mouse studies to, let's do something in humans. It's our Wright brothers moment. Many of the clinicians I talked to seemed skeptical about hitting such a difficult target. At the roundtable, the CEO of the Buck, Dr. Eric Verdon, cited a recent paper in Nature Aging, which concluded that we're already bumping against our biological ceiling. He warned about overpromising. I do worry for the credibility of our field. Diamandis was undeterrable. Peter's Law number 22, the day before something is a breakthrough, it's a crazy idea. From the stage, he exhorted his colleagues to rise to his level of certainty. Mindset is very important, he said. Optimists live 15% longer than pessimists. Humans are the only animals known to be discontented with natural selection. Sure, it created us, but we have a few notes. For instance, diabetes was beneficial for our ancestors because eating fat and sugar shifted them into insulin resistance, helping them withstand cold and famines. Nowadays, chugging a big gulp is less evolutionarily shrewd. A feature has become a bug. For millennia, we've sought a fix for debility and death. Medea of Greek myth rejuvenated her lover's father by replacing his blood with plant extracts and foam from a sacrificial werewolf, or another source has it, by boiling him in a golden cauldron. The first emperor of China, Qin Shi Huang, may well have died from mercury in an immortality potion concocted by his alchemists. Today's biohackers sometimes look to antiquity for inspiration. This usually involves hormesis, A mild ordeal, such as exercise, fasting, or cold plunges, that can shock cellular pathways into better health. For Diamandis, the first step to creating the future we want is to speak of it as if it's already here. His promise is essentially a world in which you can blithely marry someone 40 years younger than you, continue to have children even as your grandchildren are having children of their own, and keep your gaze trained on the farthest horizons in which you can stick around to witness and even determine where humanity goes next. Joe Polish, a marketing guru who has worked with Diamandis, said, "Peter has learned that a compelling offer is 10 times more powerful than a convincing argument. Now people just want to be part of his world and go wherever he's taking them." Thanks to such advances as antibiotics and better sanitation, our lifespans have roughly doubled since 1900. Back then, the leading causes of death were pneumonia, tuberculosis, and diarrhea. Now, we die of the maladies of old age: heart disease, cancer, strokes, Alzheimer's. The downside is that we go lingeringly in ways that we and our children regret. The average American dies at 77 after 12 years of bad health. If you are old enough to buy a senior citizen ticket, you are likely to have a chronic disease, or perhaps two. It once seemed that improving lifespan was nearly inevitable. Back in the 90s, a single gene mutation was found to double the longevity of the C. elegans worm, and the geroscientists Simon Lomelov and Gordon Lithgow made predictions on a bar napkin. Lithgow believed that in 5 years, mammalian lifespans would double. Lomelov, that they would more than double. Recalling the moment, Lomelov sighed and said, "The 5 to 10 year horizon for huge breakthroughs has never gotten any closer." Dr. Jordan Schlein, who runs 5 longevity clinics, told me, "Everything you do to improve your health span can improve your lifespan. Everything you do to improve your lifespan is effing bull." After several million years of evolution and 2 centuries of medical advances, human lifespans may already be highly optimized. Whereas most mammals have roughly the same number of lifetime heartbeats, 1.5 billion, humans have about 2.5 billion. Broadly speaking, if you have a finite number of heartbeats, then the faster you live, the faster you die. We're all being cooked over time. Dr. Ronald DePinho, who has done promising work to strengthen telomeres, told me, "If you want to increase longevity, you basically have to turn the oven down." An unhealthy person who starts eating Brussels sprouts and going to Planet Fitness can really turn the oven down. But most of us can't be bothered. As Dave Asprey told me, "If you would live 20 years longer if you punched yourself in the face as hard as you could 3 times every morning, no one would do it." Many people aren't even willing to undergo much milder distress. In one study, most respondents said they wouldn't be interested in a drug that made them 2 years younger if it had side effects such as occasional headaches and loose stool. Biohackers would take the drug and maybe even the punches, but their ovens are already set low. Dr. Andrea Mayer, who runs clinics in Singapore, told me, "Most of the time I'm being forced to optimize the most optimized people. What we do in longevity clinics is polish polished diamonds." According to Dr. Michael Roizen of the Cleveland Clinic, you can make a 32-year difference in your lifespan by implementing the no-brainer stuff: sleep, diet, exercise, etc. But you can gain only 4 years by taking supplements. Nonetheless, biohackers regularly tweak their stack of drugs and supplements, seeking minute advantages. The hope of combinatorics is that the interventions enhance one another. In biology, you have to work in combinations. Dr. Joseph Raphael, who runs a longevity clinic at Manhattan, told me, "If I give you urolithin A and spermidine and a hormone and nitric acid products and your autophagy, house cleaning of damaged cells, is increasing, it's like a great recipe. I may not know exactly what's contributing what, but overall it tastes good." Nathan Price, a co-director of the Center for Human Health Span at the Buck Institute, works with digital twins, virtual clones of a patient that are being developed to test treatments. Very often, multiple interventions have synergistic effects, Price said. Almost no one gets a benefit in staving off Alzheimer's from vitamin D, but people could get multiple years of benefit if they coupled vitamin D with phosphatidylcholine and better sleep and Viagra for increased blood flow. Yet, combinatorics often backfire. When young subjects took vitamin C and E before strength training, it blunted many benefits of working out. There's a pharmacological principle that when you combine three drugs, you have no idea how they're going to interact, as well as a hepatic principle that the more supplements you take, the more work your liver must do to detoxify them. Many over-the-counter supplements are contaminated with fungus, mold, yeast, salmonella, and heavy metals. When I mentioned the issues with combinatorics to Diamandis, he said, it's a very valid critique that I've also heard from my mom. He added, I'd love to start an AI company where you'd tell it what you want from your stack, more energy or nootropics or whatever, and then give it your genetic data and your medical baseline and the number of pills you're willing to swallow, and it tells you exactly what to take. In the interim, he said, opening a pouch containing his midday pills, I'm manually doing this. He recently reduced his daily load of supplements from 74 to 52 to spare his kidneys, but he's still taking more than any other patient that his Fountain Life doctor sees. Diamandis is following the evidence that we can, in fact, override our genetics. Numerous papers have concluded that genes determine only 7 to 30% of longevity, while behavioral choices play a much larger role. Your health, in this view, is not just an opportunity, but a responsibility. If you get cancer and die young, it's your fault for not perfecting your stack. One can imagine a future in which, if you didn't take every conceivable step to optimize your health, you'd face not only disapproval from your AI doctor, but denial of claims from your AI insurance company. For 4 days in March, Diamandis held his Abundance 360 conference at a resort in Rancho Palos Verdes, California. He began the final day by jogging on stage in gold sneakers to the song Forever Young and declaring that it was Longevity Day, the day that will add decades of health and centuries of inspiration to your lives. The conference curated a world of coming wonders for several hundred C-suite buccaneers who had paid up to $50,000 apiece to update their mental models and investment portfolios. One entrepreneur announced that his brain-computer interface would soon be surgically installed in primates. A venture capitalist predicted that we'd have a billion bipedal robots by 2040. There was talk of neuromuscular activation of biohybrid mobile bots and of modifying humans with DNA from tardigrades, the nearly indestructible microanimals, so that we can better withstand radiation during space travel. Diamandis welcomed each innovator to the stage with a hug and jumped exuberantly to the music, urging his audience to do likewise. He told me, I learned from Tony Robbins, that if you're the host and you're having a great time, your guests are going to be having a great time. There has to be an emotional carrier wave to make the data meaningful. Like the Italian futurist, Diamandis is drawn to dynamism, to the promise of speed. During the first Trump administration, he told me, Peter Thiel and Elon Musk asked if he might like to run NASA, and his response was colorfully and vehemently negative. Too bureaucratic. He has a venture capital mindset, invest in any emergent tech that shows promise, because you never know which unlikely breakthrough will bring mammoth returns. Yet the risks aren't just financial. In January, the Times reported that Xthera Medical, the company whose blood filters Diamandis praised at the Buck Institute, had sold thousands of its devices to a company with a clinic on Antigua that offered miracle treatments to patients with metastatic cancer. The Times described harrowingly neglectful care and said that at least six patients had died after treatment. Xthera maintains that patients were warned the treatments were experimental. The story also noted that the company continued to promote the clinic despite warnings from ex-Thera employees. When I asked Diamandis about the reporting, he said that it had paused a lot of Fountain Life's plans with ex-Thera. Then he added, listen, they've also had some incredible breakthroughs. He sometimes gets skeptical feedback from his partners at the venture firm Bold Capital. Bold has $600 million under investment, about 60% of it in health span companies. On paper, at least, the firm is showing a more than 15-fold return in Oura Ring, Figure AI, and Colossal Biosciences, which recently brought a version of the extinct direwolf back to life. Tamor Boutros-Ghali, Bold's managing partner, said, where some people imagine the 50 ways that tech can go wrong, Peter sees the 50 ways it could work and believes that human ingenuity can take care of any problems. But our investors are very happy that we don't do all of Peter's deals. One of Bold's founders, Sergey Young, told me, I'd never advise people to invest more than 2 or 3% of their wealth in longevity. It's still very early. At the Abundance Conference, the Diamandis audience seemed receptive to his reminders that the two biggest wealth creation opportunities are AI and longevity. Part of his appeal is his insistence that extending your own life and growing richer in the process will ultimately benefit the species. He conceived of an accredited patient program, an FDA-backed system that would allow select people to invest in treatments unavailable to the general public. My basic idea is I have enough money, and I'm of sound mind. I'm going to try it. He contends that the longevity-pursuing risk-takers he lives among are actually selfless. Any negative effects from technologies that don't work will be experienced by the wealthy, he said. You could see it as their sacrifice for others, both financial and, eventually, biological. Joe Polish, who helped launch A360, told me that its audience found Diamandis' optimism reassuring, but that what actually drives the abundance events is scarcity and fear of missing out. I'm going to be left behind by AI or robotics or the fountain of youth. Even the super wealthy people there are scared and trying to buy their stairway to heaven, and nearly all of them are deathly afraid of death. Most of us just want to remain in decent health and last a bit longer than the actuaries predict. The implications of extreme longevity, of a transhuman future in which we have 4 careers, 6 replacement kidneys, and 11 spouses on pods orbiting Mars, are too much for us to absorb. But Diamandis is ready for it all. Dan Sullivan, who co-hosts a podcast with Diamandis called Exponential Wisdom, said, Peter really believes that immortality is a reality. I told him, living to 156 seems reasonable, but living to 700? I don't know, Peter. I think you're going to get lonely. Our awareness of death has an upside. It imbues our lives with beauty and meaning. Immortality would redefine the nature of both empathy and morality because it would strip us of a common fate. I once asked Diamandis about the oppressive consequences if a deathless Jeff Bezos amassed $70 trillion, or if a Vladimir Putin stayed in power for a century. Another way to look at that scenario is, what are the benefits? He responded, having some visionary single decision maker allows you to be Queen Isabella funding Columbus. I fantasize about well-meaning, wealthy leaders guiding humanity with pure intent, giving top scientists the capital to take tenfold actions. Then he grinned, aware from his own fundraising how fantastical that fantasy was. Bob Richards, a close friend of Diamandis, told me, Peter believes that technology will lead us to be kind to each other, to be explorers and artists, not militaristic and greedy and self-serving, the way we are now. But just living forever is not going to change that. Diamandis told me that our hardwired inclinations towards selfishness did trouble him sometimes in the middle of the night. He added softly, I am hopeful that when there is no scarcity, the better angels of our nature will prevail. Nearly every longevity advocate believes at least 2 things that can't yet be proved. We will soon discover the secret to eternal life, and we will be better off once we do. Brian Johnson, like many others, maintains that AI is on the verge of unlocking the medical obstacles to immortality. But he acknowledged, "I don't think that anyone knows exactly how it will do so." Faith without proof is a religious outlook, and Johnson announced early this year that a religion is what his Don't Die movement would become. The words community, ethical framework, philosophy, humans won't devote their whole identity to them, he told me. Religion, for better or worse, is a framework that has motivated people to do phenomenal things. Diamandis bridles at this idea, worrying that framing the quest as a religion will discredit longevity in people's minds. Yet he knows that his own prognostications are impervious to fact-checking. Some people tell me, "Well, you've created a religion around abundance," he said, and there are elements of faith in that mindset. During A360, Diamandis interviewed his own avatar, which had supposedly time-traveled back from 2082. The avatar, which resembled a young Rafael Nadal, reported that the singularity took place on schedule and that artificial intelligence essentially solved all material scarcity problems so that the jobless became the free, living better than 2025's billionaires. Implicit in this narrative is the belief that technocrats aren't hogging resources for vanity projects. They're fixing the world. One XPRIZE health span donor, Daniel Krizek, a biotech fund manager who plans to invest $1 billion in longevity, espouses the values of effective altruism. That principle, popular in Silicon Valley, holds that philanthropists should save the most lives they can, including the billions of future lives that might be enabled by a particular action. "You could put $1 trillion into Africa and feed the continent forever," Krizek told me. "But I believe it's better to spend the trillion on going to space, because all the scientific advances that come from that will save many more lives in the future." Brian Johnson's movement aligns with this belief. His ultimate goal is species maximization, trying to get life in this part of the galaxy to flourish. Unlike some of his peers, Diamandis is eager to save current lives on Earth as well as future lives in space. He told me, "I think there is a single tide that floats all boats. AI will feed the hungry, solve the climate crisis, and get us to space." At 77, Ray Kurzweil takes 80 supplements a day, has an artificial pancreas to manage his diabetes, and appears to be in great shape. As he waits for technology to tide humanity onward, he is bewildered that some people have other plans. He used to have lunch with the economist Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel for his work on how irrational factors could cloud our decisions. Over lunch in late 2023, when Kahneman was 89, but in decent health, they debated the wisdom of extending your life. "We're at a point where problems can be reversed," Kurzweil said. "Your kidneys are failing? Well, so what? It could be solved next week." Kurzweil told me that Kahneman wasn't persuaded. Kahneman said, "Look at history. Billions of people have lived, lost most of their capabilities, and then died. Nobody has escaped that." 3 months later, Kahneman wrote to his family and friends that he had decided to die by assisted suicide. "I have believed since I was a teenager that the miseries and indignities of the last years of life are superfluous, and I am acting on that belief." Kurzweil sighed, recalling the loss. "People really don't want to be non-functional, but it's death that's the tragedy. Death is the loss of information, beauty, love, everything we know." For many biohackers, the ultimate goal is simply the preservation of their own consciousness. One constraint on retaining information forever is that our neurons mostly don't replicate themselves. They just shrink, deteriorate, and die. But Kurzweil has a fix for that, too. Decades back, he predicted that we'd soon be able to scan and copy our connectome, the intricate web of 100 billion neurons that constitutes the human brain. At A360, a nanotechnologist named Michael Andreg declared that Kurzweil's prophecy was all but realized. Andreg co-founded a startup called Eon Systems. His hypothesis is that because consciousness arises from bioelectric signals, you'll be able to turn your digital brain on in the cloud and experience a thoroughly satisfying life up there, or out there, or wherever, because AI will predict your neurons' next signal, brain auto-complete. He showed an emulated fruit fly whose connectome had been copied to a Kinko's level of fidelity. It skittered around on screen in a somewhat staccato fashion, and it knew enough to groom itself and to avoid bitter taste, though how there could be bitter taste in the digital realm was never explained. Andreg said that the human connectome was only a million times more complex than a fruit fly's, so all we have to do is model our brain structure and activity, and voila, emulation. We could be scanned and wake up in a digital body by 2030. This is a whole new body, a whole new brain. This is transcendence. No one can fully emulate a C. elegans worm yet, despite 14 years of trying. The best program can't even make the worm move backward. Yet Andreg told me that the difficulties he foresaw were chiefly psychological. The first person to do the upload, it will be destructive. We pause you, lock down all your proteins, and slice your brain with a big deli slicer. But much finer, at the 100 micron level. Nonetheless, he said, we have at least 10 volunteers who want to be the first to do it. Well, the second. When I asked Diamandis about the plausibility of whole brain emulation, he pointed out that Andreg was featured in the Moonshots part of his program. He was ambivalent about eventually uploading his own connectome. Destroying myself to upload feels like suicide, and if I'm somehow still here after the upload, destroying myself because my peer in the cloud says, I'm good, you can kill yourself, I'm not sure that I'm ready for that. Uncharacteristically, he acknowledged having qualms about Kurzweil's nanobots, too, particularly if they crossed the blood-brain barrier. I'd probably do nanotechnology, he said, but it begins to enter a re-engineering of the brain and of our personas. You have to ask, at what point do we stop being human? In May, at an auditorium near Gramercy Park in Manhattan, XPRIZE HealthSpan introduced the 100 semifinalists who'd advanced from the more than 600 teams that signed up. Before the ceremony, in a conference room upstairs, Diamandis and Jamie Justice gave 30 investors a preview of the competition and urged them to fund teams that fire their imaginations. We aren't just going to slow aging, Justice said, but to improve function in just 1 year. Diamandis clarified, effectively a functional reversal. I want to get the word reversal in there. Downstairs, he welcomed a standing room only crowd by asking, who wants an extra 20 years of healthy life? Everyone, pretty much. Who wants more than that? Woo! He went on as if the prize had already been won. That 20 years will be the bridge to the next 20 years. And that 20 years will be the bridge to the 20 years after that. The semifinalists from more than 30 countries were pursuing an extraordinary array of approaches, including AI-based short-chain fatty acid modulation, extracellular vesicles derived from cow plasma, ultrasound to target senescent cells, kidney-strengthening tinctures, olfactory enhancement with 40 odors, including eucalyptus and lavender, coffee that targets the mitochondria with exogenous ketones, and a longevity village called Futureville, where the health practitioners are holograms. Perhaps because the testing period doesn't begin until 2026, the room shimmered with the optimism of 100 as yet undisproved hypotheses. Aubrey de Grey was present, delighted that the competition he'd suggested nearly 20 years earlier was robustly underway. And yet, he told me, the tests for strength, cognition, and immune function that will determine a winner are unlikely to be sufficiently spanning of all the pathways of aging that they would increase lifespan. For lifespan, every pathway has to be delayed. If you delay changes in 90% of the pathways, you're still going to die. and probably right on schedule. Even many of the Amanda's close friends don't quite believe that we'll reach longevity escape velocity anytime soon. Dave Blunden, his partner in an AI venture fund, told me, "When you're Peter's age, you're right on the longevity cusp. That's the tragedy of the whole Peter story. He could live forever, or he could miss by a year and not live any longer at all. It'll be close." When I asked Diamandis about his friend's observation, he looked stricken, as if Blunden were consigning him to an early grave. "I acknowledge that a lot of the initial research hasn't panned out, that rapamycin, caloric restriction, NAD plus are individual pebbles dropped in an ocean of biochemical complexity," he said. "We don't really understand the biology of aging yet." He fell silent, running projections. "If we're not able to move the needle so everyone gets 20 to 30 more healthy years in the next 25 years, I'd consider that a failure." Then he brightened. "That's about the buffer in years that I'm going to need to get to the moon." He mentioned one more seminal book, Robert Heinlein's sci-fi collection, The Man Who Sold the Moon. The man in question, D.D. Harriman, longs to go to the moon, but his vision and salesmanship are so vital to a moon colonization program that his colleagues maneuver to keep him on Earth. "Anyway," Diamandis explained, "Harriman finally sneaks up to the moon on an illegal flight, and he dies there." He laughed. "I don't want to die on the moon exactly, but I'd love to start a city there, a base we could mine asteroids from. The last time something like this happened is when the lungfish crawled out of the ocean onto land." Diamandis looked off, somewhere between ahead and above. "The equation of humanity moving into the cosmos is complicated," he admitted. He knew that it might not happen or be optimal for all of us if it did, but it still gives me permission to dream. Next, from the August 16, 2025 online edition, "Always Inadequate. The force of low self-esteem can feel so enormous, so unexplainable, it seems almost mythic," by Vivian Gornick. In the late 1960s, I lived for a year with my then husband in the middle of an apple orchard in northern New Mexico, some miles from the glorious Rio Grande Gorge. Our adobe house was equipped with nothing but electricity, no plumbing, no running water. So a fair amount of physical labor was necessary to get through each day. This was fine with me. My husband and I were both in our 30s, and, like many of our generation, preoccupied with finding ourselves. I, by writing something I could think well of, my husband by finishing a dissertation that had long been languishing. But, as I was often gripped by the conviction that any writer 10 years my junior was already more accomplished than I'd ever be, I welcomed the time spent hauling water or raking the wood stove. One day, we paid a visit to the D.H. Lawrence Ranch, 10 or 15 miles north of our house. The ranch, long the property of the University of New Mexico, was now run as a writer's retreat, with a single writer of reputation occupying the privileged position of writer in residence. That year, it was Henry Roth, the author of the 1934 masterpiece Call It Sleep, a book I held in high regard. When we stepped out of the car, my husband unexpectedly suggested that we look in on Roth. "Oh, no," I instantly shot back. "We can't do that." "Why not?" "Well, we'd be intruding." "Nonsense. I'm sure he'd love it." It was typical of us in those years that, whatever the suggestion, I almost invariably said no, whereas my outgoing husband just as invariably said yes. I always thought I was simply exercising good critical judgment in opposition to my husband's indiscriminate eagerness. It never occurred to me that perhaps some anxiety lay at the heart of my dismissiveness. On that afternoon at the Lawrence Ranch, however, my husband's yes prevailed. A tall, friendly-faced woman answered the door, Mrs. Roth, as it turned out, and, in a voice as friendly as her face, told us that the great man was asleep. She couldn't wake him, but who, she wanted to know, were we, and where had we come from? When we told her where we lived, she said that they'd heard of the orchard and longed to have some of its apples. "Well, come on down and take all you want," my husband said. "How about Sunday?" Mrs. Roth suggested. "Fine," we said, and went on our way. On Sunday morning, I woke up, yawned and stretched, and said to my husband, "Let's take a walk at the gorge." "Well, we can't do that," he said. "The Roths are coming." "Oh, don't be silly," I said. "They're not going to come." "Sure they will," he said. "No," I insisted, "they won't. I want to go to the gorge." Within an hour, we were in the car. When we returned late in the afternoon, there was a note on the door. It was, of course, from the Roths. They were sorry not to have found us at home. They'd been looking forward to a visit and hoped we didn't mind that they'd picked a bag full of apples. It was almost as though their feelings had been hurt by finding us gone. My husband stood holding the note in his hand, looking at me as though seeing something in me he'd not seen before. "Why did you do this?" he asked softly. It would be many decades before I could answer that question. A woman sits alone in her apartment, perishing for want of company. She has a number of friends with whom she might spend the evening. She need only pick up the phone and call, but she's seen them all within the past week and cannot imagine that any one of them would want to see her again so soon. She makes no calls. At a dinner party, a man dominates the conversation, speaking nonstop for nearly 10 minutes. He knows that he's burning his social bridges behind him, but he does not trust that his presence will be recalled, much less well-regarded, should he fall silent. He goes on talking, even as every eye in the room glazes over. Another man, independently wealthy, is always borrowing small, niggling amounts of money from friends and acquaintances, which he routinely forgets to pay back. No matter how much privilege he enjoys, he can never feel sufficiently taken care of. I once had a mentor who could only correct, never praise. It was years before I realized how bitter her assessment of her own abilities was. When one thinks of all the calls not made, the courtesies ignored, the way others are made to feel small in our presence, or we in theirs, the sheer meanness of little everyday confrontations. Yet, it is also true that the influence of negative self-regard over character formation can be remarkably varied. I have a friend of many years, I'll call her Diane, who suffers mightily from the suspicion that she is not worthy of the world's affection. She grew up feeling not only unloved, but unlovable. Instead of developing into someone driven to act out the injured self in the ways I have been describing, Diane's instinct since childhood has been to engage affectionately with humanity at large. For her, the pain of feeling unlovable is assuaged by acting as though she lives in a garden of earthly delights, where all the other animals are creatures of equal interest and value. Hers is the gift of making all who come her way feel, "You enchanting creature, I could happily go on talking to you for the rest of my life." What Diane yearns to have others think of her, she bestows on her every interlocutor. In other people's lives, Diane's self-abasement is the cause of emotional nourishment. The solipsism of low self-esteem is one of the wonders of the human psyche. So inexplicable is its grip, so binding its influence, it can feel almost mythic. And why not? Myths are what we invent to accommodate the mysteries of nature, our own, if not those of our surroundings. Scientists can explain daylight and darkness, gravity and rainfall, but who, after all, can explain why we are born with a need to think well of ourselves? And why, when we don't, life becomes an exercise in humiliation. According to biblical myth, human beings were at one with all the dumb animals of the earth until we ate of the tree of knowledge, whereupon we became a race divided against itself. On the one hand, the gift of consciousness brought the glory of independence. On the other, the punishment of separateness. Now we were proud but lonely. The loneliness proved our undoing. It so perverted our instincts that we became strangers to ourselves, the true meaning of alienation, and thus to all others. Many cultures have felt tasked with the problem of restoring some semblance of that imagined inner wholeness, in the hope that humanity will be freed of its emotional isolation. In our own time, that of the therapeutic age, we have come to believe that if people could purge themselves of all their hidden fears and anxieties and learn to occupy their conscious selves fully and freely, they would find that they were no longer alone. They would have themselves for company. As soon as one had company, one could feel benign toward others. Ah, therein lies the promised land. But the therapeutic age is now more than a century old, and the problem has proved intractable. I think often, and always with regret, of that long ago Sunday afternoon in New Mexico when feelings of inadequacy drove me to flee a meeting with a person of accomplishment. It's not the inadequacy I regret, that I believe to be very nearly existential. It's the flight. I daydream about how differently someone similarly afflicted might have acted. Take Diane, for instance. Not only would she have been there to welcome the Roths, she would have baked them an apple pie. And now, from the August 14, 2025 online edition, a flash fiction story, An Open Heart by Jamil Jan Kokai. They cut open my father's chest and splayed his ribs out beneath their halogen lamps, and inside his heart they inserted a ticking device whose purpose we couldn't exactly discern. And then they sewed him back up like a pouch of coins and sent him out into the cold world with a bomb tick-tucking away in his chest, his scar like a border dividing a formerly peaceful tribe into warring political factions or rival criminal gangs, who will cut open a man's chest and rip out his heart and eat a chunk, to demonstrate, I think, the depth of their barbarity. But what my father notices when he sits in our living room to watch grainy cell phone footage of this performance is that the cannibal grimaces while eating the human heart, as if not totally committed to the act, even though, my father argues, if he, watching the footage, has noticed the grimace, then surely rival gang members will have noticed the weakness too, and that will condemn not only the cannibal but his associates, former commandos trained by the Navy SEALs or the Foreign Legionnaires or Mossad, who, in a matter of months, will be hunted down and turned into the videos my father watches in our living room, despite the fact that I blocked the websites where he finds these videos, and because I suspect that my brother is secretly sending him new websites, I confront him about it when he returns home from the butcher shop where he works. But of course, my brother denies everything and blames the algorithm of our father's Facebook. And when I tell him that you don't see gore on Facebook, he says you don't see gore on American Facebook, but on Afghan Facebook, people post dead bodies all the time. And I say, but those Afghans are publicizing war crimes. And he says, it all F's with your head just the same. And I say, if you know it F's with your head, then why keep sending him videos? To which my brother responds, remember when three guys, one hammer, was spreading around at school, and Aziz sent me the clip on MySpace, and I watched it in short snippets, feeling sick the whole time? And even later that night, whenever I closed my eyes, I saw the dead man's face floating above me. So I gave up on sleep and went out to the living room and found Dad sitting in the dark, shirtless and bleary-eyed and watching TV. And I sat down near him. And on the television, gray wolves were stripping the carcass of a caribou. And at some point, while watching the wolves, Dad put his hand on the sofa cushion next to me. But when I reached out to touch him, Dad flinched and pulled away because, it turned out, he had been asleep the whole time. And it took him a moment to realize where he was and who I was. And, really, just to fill up the silence, I asked him if he had sleepwalked before. And Dad said that during the Soviet War, when he used to sleep on the roof of his home in Logar, he'd wake up in nearby orchards or fields or in front of a random house, which, minutes later, would get bombed. And he said it took him two nights to realize what God wanted from him. And after that, every time he woke up in front of a home, he would bang on the door until someone came out. And he saved eight families from bombings before word spread to the local communists that a boy in the village had intel on Soviet airstrikes. And within a few days, he was kidnapped and smuggled into a government dungeon, where he was interrogated for hours by two Russians and an Afghan, who accused him of having a source on the inside. And when Dad asked, "Inside what?" the Russians stripped him of his clothes and brought out a rusty drill stained with blood. And Dad lied and claimed that his source was named Arman, just Arman, after which he was hauled up two flights of stairs into an ordinary office space, and there, in a conference room, he was instructed to look into an adjacent conference room filled with Armands drinking vodka. And when the interrogators asked Dad which Arman was his Arman, Dad picked out an Arman at random, who, with a bottle still in hand, was dragged off and tortured for days until he was shot in the head and tossed into the same cell as Dad, where, fortunately, in the constant dark, Dad could not see his mutilated face. And at first, Dad ignored his cellmate, or cursed him, or kicked his corpse. But after a while, he apologized to Arman. Over and over, he apologized. Until one night, Arman said that he wouldn't forgive him. And in response, Dad cried, "I'm going mad, aren't I?" And Arman replied, "You seem fine to me." And for several nights and days, Dad didn't say a word, hoping that Arman wouldn't speak again. But the moment Dad gave in and called out to him in a fit of loneliness, Arman replied, "Oh, so now you want to talk." And he did, and they did. They chatted for weeks, then months, during which Arman recounted his life in the slums with his father and five older sisters, his vegetable cart, his policeman uncle, his exemplary test scores, his acceptance into a prestigious military academy, his first interactions with communists, with the works of Marx and Lenin, his meetings with Tarakai and Babrak and Najibullah, the Najibullah, who took Arman under his wing and convinced him to join KHAD, and in the end cradled Arman's head and wiped away his tears before shooting him in the face. But although Dad appreciated Arman's stories, the way they killed time, he noticed inconsistencies in Arman's narratives. One night, Arman's father was a brutish drunk, coming home from the brickyard to beat his children at random. But the next night, he was a sickly coward who had failed to protect Arman and his sisters from rapist policemen. And on some nights, Arman's mother had died giving birth, and on others, she withered away from sickle cell anemia. But Dad was careful never to contradict his cellmate for fear of losing his company. Until one day, Arman scoffed at the idea of a life beyond death. And Dad pointed out the irony of a ghost denying the afterlife, to which Arman replied, "The closest I have ever come to feeling faith was when I was 12 years old and I went to the mosque to steal sandals. It was autumn. It was Juma, and the trees in the courtyard were dying so beautifully, and with a big bag of sandals in hand, I heard the new imams recite a hadith in which the archangel Jibril tore out the heart of the prophet, peace be upon him, and I found myself so mesmerized by the story that I sort of sleepwalked into the mosque. But as I pressed through the rows of worshipers, someone grabbed my arm and the bag of sandals and outed me as a thief, and a mob quickly formed and hauled me outside and tied me to the base of a mulberry tree. And I don't know how many times they whipped me before I passed out, but I woke up on a cot in the mosque, bandaged all over, with the new imam sitting nearby, reading the Quran. And when I asked the imam why he hadn't stopped the mob, he sent me away with 200 Afghanis in my pocket. But out in the courtyard, I found that my own sandals had been stolen. And it was at this point in the story, with Armand sitting on the steps of the mosque, barefoot and bandaged, that Dad fell entirely into his hallucination. He said that he saw the mulberry tree in the courtyard spotted with blood, and he smelled rain and smoke in the air, and he heard a street vendor call out, Baraki, Baraki. So mournfully, you might have thought it was the name of his dead mother. And Dad said that he felt the wounds on his back reopening. And in that moment, he said he wanted everything, including himself, to die. Not only to die, but to be cast back into oblivion. And Dad said that in the same moment, he wanted everything, including himself, to live. Not only to live, but to live eternally, without pain and just when Dad felt that his heart was going to burst from his chest, Armand stopped speaking altogether, and 3 days later, Dad was released in some sort of bureaucratic mix-up, and he returned home only to discover that his village had been obliterated, and so he traveled through the mountains into Peshawar, and there he found his family practically starving in a refugee camp, and when he approached his mother near her tent, all he said was, Mother. And she looked up and fainted, because, you see, everyone had thought that Dad was dead. And it was as if he'd returned to them a ghost. And he said that he felt like a ghost. And even sitting with me that night telling his story, he was conscious of the fact that everything he said sounded preposterous, like a fever dream. And if he had not lived his life, he said he would not believe it either. And I remember thinking that Dad still wasn't completely awake, because he never spoke like that again. We're out of time for today's issue of The New Yorker. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and are pre-prepared. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.